From the news centre at 5, a man who attempted to kill his fiancée by burying her alive in a cardboard box has been jailed for 20 years. Marcin Kaspjak attacked Mikalina Lewandowska with a taser and bound and gagged her before burying her in nearby woodland in Huddersfield. Teachers could find themselves in the firing line if they don't meet high enough standards. The Education Secretary wants poorly performing teachers to be identified earlier on and, if necessary, sacked. The idea has the backing of school heads. But Christine Blower from the National Union of Teachers says some weaker staff may just need extra training.
What we need to do is make sure that we're supporting all of our teachers to the very best of our ability, and that may very well mean putting more money in to make sure that their skills remain at the right level and that their information is at the right level.
The wife of an Oxford University professor who was found dead at a colleague's home says she believes his death was a tragic accident. A fellow don has been released on bail after being arrested on suspicion of murdering Stephen Rawlings. Eurozone countries, including France and Italy, are reportedly facing a credit downgrade. Just Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium and Luxembourg are likely to be spared. The credit agency Standard & Poor's is expected to make the move after US markets close this evening. Our economics editor Ed Conway says the affected countries are usually told 12 hours before an official announcement.
That's why we've had this increasing kind of amount of news coming out of sources throughout Europe. Logistically, for these countries, it means that theoretically it becomes more difficult to borrow money. And given that at the moment they're struggling to borrow money at all, it's the last thing they really need.
A student could be forced to stand trial in the US for allegedly breaking copyright laws. Richard O'Dwyer ran the TV Shack website, which helps people watch films and TV programmes for free. And the Albert Hall is at the centre of a ticket-touting controversy. A legal loophole means seats owned by members can be resold for a profit. That's the latest. I'm Chloe Colpin.
BCFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Cadbury Heath, Martin Palmer. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we've heard about soldiers being paid more in the private sector. But what about British Army psychological warfare officers getting paid 20 times more working in strategic communications? Plus, Filton Airfield, we ask how can it make sense to chase Airbus and Rolls-Royce out of town? And from the European Particle Research Centre near Geneva, CERN, our guest went on to set up the Forum for Stable Currencies. Now Sabine McNeill is campaigning for victims of miscarriages of justice. That's in the second hour after 6. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of freezing, that's zero, and dry. This weekend, highs of 5 degrees Celsius, sunny and dry. Next week, highs of 7 Celsius, sunny, cold and dry at the beginning of the week, slightly warmer and wetter towards the end of the week. And next weekend, that's the 21st and 22nd of January, highs of 7 Celsius, some sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And before we introduce this week's guests, today, of course, is Friday the 13th. But what is the origin of Friday the 13th? Martin Summers, old Labour Oxford economist, is here. Martin, do you know anything about this?
Well, I understand that Freya's Day, Friday, is the goddess Freya's Day, and she was a woman, of course, the only woman on 13 is the lunar number, and therefore patriarchal history suggests that that's a bad day because it's a woman's day, a 13 and Freya's Day, the 13th, bad for some people.
Well, that's what they were saying. In fact, saying it was a bad day this morning on the Daily Service on Radio 4 Longwave. But I beg to differ with them. To start with, the actual date was Friday the 13th of October 1307, which this is all based on, and it's all to do with the arrest of the old order, the Knights Templar, who were, of course, the world's first ever international bankers. They were arrested by the King of France back on Friday the 13th of October 1307. So you might say that was actually quite a good day. The Templars, certainly, but they were accused of all sorts of corruption and crimes, a whole list of them. And many people say that the Templars were wrongly arrested because because confessions were beaten out of them in torture. And of course, there was some torture going on in those days. This was the Middle Ages, after all. But actually, very few people realised that there were three genuine ex-Templars who'd left the order, who confessed quite freely in the spring of 1307. That was Esquin of Floyan, Bernard Pellet, and Gerard of Bizol, the three knights, who ex-Templars, all confessed to some pretty horrific stuff as part of the initiation into this private order of knighthood. So that was in the spring of 1307. Then we had the accusations against these knights, which were doing things like spitting on the cross, denying Jesus, worshipping an ebony human skull, and they weren't permitted to deny any sex when ordered. So that was essentially the beginnings of this idea of Friday the 13th, and that was the day which Philip IV of France ordered 5,000 Templars arrested because he believed that they were actually a criminal order, and they were arrested for heresy and tried. Jacques de Molay, who was the chief of the Knights Templar, he was executed in 1314, a little bit later on. That information I got from something called The Illustrated History of the Crusades and the Crusader Knights by Charles Phillips. There's also a lot of rumours that the Templars, even after they'd been disbanded and arrested by the King of France, went up to Scotland and did something called Roslyn Chapel, which is this weird little chapel. And one of the reasons that people think this was the Templars is because there were carvings made in this chapel, which you can still go and see today, of the aloe vera plant, which of course was not native to Europe at all. In fact, it was only known of in America. And so it seems that the Knights Templar had been to America well before anybody knew about it. Anyway, Umberto Eco writes about this too in his book Foucault's Pendulum, and you can read more about that sort of thing if you're interested in Umberto Eco's book. So that's Friday the 13th done with, and let's introduce Cadbury Heath councillor Martin Palmer. Hi Martin, welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you very much.
Can you just tell us a bit about what got you into politics, Martin?
Well, what got me into politics? I've been a Labour member now for about for a few years. I basically got into politics back in, or seriously got into politics back in May 2010, just after the general election. Basically, I was heavily into politics as I suppose a young apprentice and a young craftsman at Rolls Royce back in the 80s. And I think the result of May 2010. Just basically hit me and I thought we were going to go back, and I think we basically are going back to what we had to face in the 80s. And I remember then back in the 80s, hospital closures, destruction of our services, and that event in May 2010, Labour losing the election, basically stimulated me to actually get more involved and active in local politics.
So why Labour and not one of the other parties?
Why Labour? Because I. Really, it's because of my background. Parents basically worked for the National Health Service in Ham Green, a hospital that was closed by the Tories, by the way. And basically, what is Labour all about? In one word, it's about fairness. And I think with the other parties, with the Tories, you don't get that fairness.
So many people say that actually it doesn't really make any difference anymore who you vote for, because all of the three main parties have essentially the same kind of agenda on the big issues.
I don't believe that's true. What I've basically witnessed, I think, since I've been actively involved in politics is that that's not the case at all. I think the one party that I feel is actually fighting for people is the Labour Party. I think the Tories have got vested interest protecting protecting the wealthy. I don't feel that's a fair comment.
So are you still actually working at Rolls-Royce?
Exactly. Yes. Working at Rolls-Royce, so I basically joined the aerospace business straight from school, straight at 16, as an apprentice.
So what are your first impressions? And you've just got into politics only fairly recently. You know, what's your impressions, and how does it live up to your expectations or not?
I would encourage anybody to actually get involved with politics. I think if anybody's got a passion, if anybody actually wants to change things, I would actually say go out and do it. Because I think just within the last few months, I feel as it, you can go out, actually make a difference, have a tussle with your local MP, which I've done with Chris Skidmore a couple of times. And I would say, yeah, encourage anybody to basically get involved. You can actually make a difference, because there are so few people out there that they're actually active.
So you're saying there's room at the top, in a way?
There is room at the top, definitely.
Yeah. So what sort of things do you feel over the last year or so since you've been involved in politics, where you actually feel, wow, I made a difference there?
I would say it's the whole activist thing. Like I say, so few people are actually involved with politics. I think, you know, if you just apply a little bit of pressure, and I've been involved in a couple of groups. One was I became a secretary of a group that we formed with local trade unionists to actually fight the defence cuts. Basically, we got our names into newspapers, met Liam Fox, and that was just, I would say, a group of activists just making a noise, getting your name in the newspaper, and you can actually make a difference. And also with the Save Filton Airfield campaign, a few people coming together, passionate, and I must admit, with the Save Filton Airfield campaign, that was people involved with politics across from the Labour Party, Liberals, and also with the Tories as well. But again, we got out there, got active, and yeah, obviously the result of the Save Filton Airfield is, I suppose, it's you know, the jury's probably still out at the moment. But yeah, people who are passionate can make a difference in politics. And like I said, I'd encourage anybody who's out there. There's probably people more passionate, more articulate than I am, and I'll encourage the people out there. Yeah, get involved.
Definitely. Okay, thanks, Martin. The other Martin Summers, is here too. Martin, you're an old Labour Oxford economist. What do you make of the announcement this week, which hasn't really been covered that much on our news, of the Swiss bank chief, Philipp Hildebrand, quits? Because one of the reasons I ask is because we keep thinking of the Eurozone as the problem area. Well, it looks as if in Switzerland there's also a problem. He's quit because his wife made controversial currency trades, supposedly without his knowledge, where he benefited to the tune of 75,000 Swiss francs in just 2 months from actually a bit of insider dealing, basically, where he's told his wife, it appears, quickly make these little deals, and then when there's a change in the currencies, he's netted this massive sum. I'm not quite sure what this is in terms of pounds. I think it's $500,000? Certainly, but anyway, what about the resignation of the finally? Of
well,
this,
I mean, to be honest with you, when people like him get caught out, it's very much the exception rather than the rule. I mean, they've recently done a study in the US of Congress people, and they found that they're all millionaires, of course, as they are in the US if you're in serious high level politics, and they've all got share portfolios, but their share portfolios mysteriously do better consistently by 15% than everybody else's. And that is, of course, because they're sitting on all the committees that decide the rules and regulations about various things, and they just have a quiet word in their wife's ear, who then has a word with her dealer, and then they take an insider position, and therefore they make money. And this is actually normal practice in the financial markets, and has been for donkey's years.
Yes, it's,
and occasionally, once in a while, they get caught out and they have to walk, but it's very occasionally.
Yeah, so it's £272,000 apparently was made. The trades were made 3 weeks before the Swiss National Bank set a minimum exchange rate of 1.2 Swiss francs per euro to stem massive inflows of money from the Eurozone, which was hurting the Swiss economy. So why would all this money going into Switzerland hurt the Swiss economy?
It forces up the Swiss currency in value, and that means that Swiss exports, they do quite a lot of exports of machine tools and things of that sort, and that chokes off their markets. And the Swiss have always been at the centre of money laundering. I mean, I remember meeting Swiss colleagues at conferences years ago, and they're saying, we have big washing machines and we wash everything in Switzerland. And of course, the other thing, of course, is that loads of British nationals have got accounts in Switzerland on which they've not paid proper income tax. And a deal was recently done whereby they could repatriate some of the money that they owed, and then they would be let off the rest of what they were owed. So a deal has been done by the British government with the Swiss authorities in order that these people will pay a fraction of what they are supposed to have paid, and then we'll settle it with that. And of course, in actual fact, these people should pay everything they're supposed to have paid, and the deal only covers individual accounts, and many people have actually got corporate accounts there which haven't got an individual name on them, so they're excluded. And of course, it undermines mind the whole EU position towards Switzerland, because the EU were trying to negotiate with Switzerland about income tax evasion, because many Greek income tax evaders, for example, got their money in Switzerland, and the British deal has undermined the whole EU position of trying to force them to be more open about what they do.
Okay.
So that's the British for you.
Now, I've just been doing a little bit of mental arithmetic. The £272,000 was the actual amount of his own personal money that his wife used to do this little deal. The profit was actually only £50,000. So, Martin, do you think actually it's right that he should resign? Because he's only made 50 grand out of this little deal.
I think he should resign, yeah. But I think the one thing I jotted down, you know, what drives these people? You know, what drives them? Here's a guy that's probably making a lot more than £50,000 a year, and yet he's obviously used, well, I assume he's used his wife to actually do this insider trading. But it's that's a question, Mark, I have.
But isn't it difficult? I mean, imagine if you knew that there was going to be something happening in a few days' time, and you could make yourself 50 grand if you did a little deal. Wouldn't you do it?
I'm not entirely sure that I would. Unfortunately, I never parted to this sort of information, so I probably wouldn't.
Martin, what about the ethics here? Is it really possible to expect someone not to make £50,000 if they can do it at a drop of a hat?
He's the head of the Swiss Central Bank, so he is in fact supposedly a public servant. Yeah, that's the bottom line here, and he's basically a public servant in malfeasance in office. He's got to go. End of story.
So is he going to be prosecuted? Should he go to jail?
He should be prosecuted and sent to jail. Ultimately, the problem with all of these frauds that have been going on is fines are not a deterrent, because the fines never cover the amount that's been defrauded. So the only way to punish these people is to send them to prison. In the savings and loans collapse in the 1980s in the US, thousands of top executives were sent to prison. In the bigger crisis that we've been in now, nobody or hardly anybody has been sent to prison, and that's the only deterrent for this kind of behaviour.
Now, the Swiss banks don't come into the news that often, but if you remember last year, there was a whistleblower, a guy called Rudolf Elmer. He handed over a couple of CDs with loads of names of what he believed were potential tax evaders. This was basically secret names relating to Swiss bank accounts, and now he's been convicted, instead of being a whistleblower, of data theft. This is just at the end of last year. I was looking into what was going on in Switzerland. This guy was paraded around the press beginning of 2010 as a great, fantastic guy. A whistleblower has handed over this to WikiLeaks, all this information which may help convict people. He himself is now going to go to jail.
Well, that's because the wealthy write the rules, and that's the sort of situation we're in. Basically, the political power of the banks is enormous. It was enormous before the crash, and it's even bigger now, because they're basically sitting there with a suicide belt on, saying, doing everything we say, otherwise we'll blow ourselves up and you too. And therefore
this,
the politicians go, we'll just have to go along with whatever you want.
This kind of threatening tactic by the banks surely only works for a while. I mean, after a while, people realise they're crying
wolf.
They'll
carry on doing what they're doing until they hit the wall, which they're about to do, and then people will... basically, most people want a quiet life. They know there are people wealthier than them getting on with things, and as long as they're looked after, and you know their jobs are solid, and they've got a clear career path, and their children seem to be doing all right, they're not that bothered about what goes on at the top, provided they're looked after. But once they realise that the people in charge are A, venal, and B, incompetent, then they start to get angry, especially if their own circumstances are going to be significantly damaged by their behaviour.
So you seem to be implying here that the people in charge, are you talking about the politicians, actually, really, the bankers are in charge,
yes,
not the politicians.
It's always been the way. I mean, this is the problem. The politicians are put up in front of the public. I mean, the whole MP's expenses scandal was a flipping storm in a teacup. Yes, of course there were various fiddles going on and it should have been looked into, but that was actually a whole psychological warfare operation. The banks were looting the economy at that stage, and instead of the politicians ripping into them on behalf of the rest of the population, they were too busy defending their own corner. And that was quite deliberate, and a deliberate ploy by those in charge. We don't really have a democracy, we have an oligarchy. That's always been the way, not much has changed. There was a period from World War II until the mid-70s when the oligarchy were kind of kept in check, and then they got bored of that and then decided to go back to what they used to be able to do before that, and that's why we're in the mess we're in now. And ultimately, ultimately they'll have to be brought to heel. They will be brought to heel because they're making such a mess of things that even the most stupid people are going to realise that, what they're up to.
Well, let's bring this a little bit closer to home, because cash-strapped Bristol City Council has announced this earlier this week that it's going to borrow £50 million. The Lib Dem-controlled council said it's investing in Bristol's future fund will go towards school and transport projects. Well, this is the kind of stuff, Martin, or which Martin am I talking to? Martin Farmer this time. This is the sort of stuff that used to be funded just simply from council tax receipts and from central government, I don't know what they call it now, the old rate support grant. Now they're having to borrow money just to maintain services.
Yeah, I'm a little bit. I must admit, I'm totally confused by this one, because I think from the report it says that the Bristol City Council cut 28 million, plans to cut another 21 million from its budget, and yet it's now going out to borrow 50 million. I mean, that's whilst I'm trying to do the arithmetic, but I suppose per head of population in Bristol, that's putting a massive debt on each resident of Bristol. Also, it's obviously basically putting the Bristol City Council into debt for years to come. I'm just trying to work out the arithmetic for why that's happening.
Well, I mean, basically, they're having their central government grant cut, so they're trying to make up for it by borrowing. And in a way, I can see why they're doing that. They're trying to make. I mean, we've got a Liberal Democrat council who's just trying to make up at local level for the incompetence and stupidity of their own colleagues at Westminster. They shouldn't be cutting money to local councils at this stage of the game. It's an absolutely idiotic thing to do. It'll just plunge the local economy into chaos.
But interest rates are low at the moment. Do you think actually this is quite sensible, rather than actually hemorrhaging into our services?
I mean, I think it makes more sense to borrow the money to keep services going than it does to cut the services. But of course, they shouldn't be cutting the services in the first place, and that's the fault of central government and macroeconomic mistakes they're making.
But Martin Farmer, you can imagine a giant great credit card over the top of the city. Suddenly it's starting to rack up,
exactly,
isn't it?
I mean, the one thought in my mind, unfortunately, I'm sort of based in South Gloucestershire, not in Bristol. I suppose the cynical side of me thinks, well, there's a Liberal-controlled council. I'm not sure when the next elections are, but are they really just trying to keep the council tax at the same level, just to put themselves in a good position for when the next election comes?
I think they probably are.
Okay,
but then that's what in a way you can hardly blame them. That's what politicians are supposed to do, isn't it?
Okay, well, let's bounce from Bristol back up to Westminster. And this week at Prime Minister's Questions, the first one of the new year, we had a bit of an exchange between David Cameron, the leader of the Conservative Party and the Coalition, and Ed Miliband. And let's assess, how did he do this week in his first, after quite a lot of criticism over Christmas and the new year, how did Ed do?
The Prime Minister.
I think it is time for him to listen to his Defence Secretary, who wrote very candidly over Christmas, there is a difference between populism and popularity, and that difference is called credibility. Time to have some, I think.
Ed Miliband.
Mr. Speaker, instead of his pre-prepared lines, he should get his facts right about his own policy. He's just wrong. He is wrong. He says that he's continuing the policy of the last Labour government.
This is on train fares.
And he's simply wrong on the facts. The last Labour government saw what the train companies were doing and said we were going to put an end to it. Now, the Prime Minister said at the weekend he wanted to take action against crony capitalism. He's failed at the first hurdle. And I asked him for the last time, Mr. Speaker, will he now reverse the policy?
If we're now on to the issue of higher people's pay, do we want to address that? Okay, let me go back on the issue of the rail fares. On the issue of the rail fares, let me be absolutely clear. Labour introduced the policy of 5% flexibility. They changed it for 1 year only for an election year, but with no intention of making that permanent. And if he doesn't know that, he should. Now, if he wants to get on to the issue of executive pay, I think he's entirely right to raise this issue. And unlike a government that did nothing...
I want to hear the answer, and however long it takes... Order! Order! And however long it takes, I will. The Prime Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think he is right to raise the issue of executive pay, and unlike the last government that did nothing for 13 years, this government will act.
That was Prime Minister's Questions from Wednesday this week. Martin Summers, what do you make of that? Because he's chosen actually quite a good subject, I think. Rail fares, this affects, you know, millions of people across the country. They're having to pay something like 10% more, even though, of course, their disposable income is generally going down to use the train. This is likely to force people back into their cars. It's crazy. So he's chosen the right subject, but he didn't really stick the knife in, did he?
Well, I think the Prime Minister's Questions, to be honest, really annoys me. I mean, we try and get away from that Yarboo sucks approach.
Well, surely that's the job
programme.
Of the Speaker, to actually keep it on subject.
No, it's also the culture of the House of Commons. I went to watch the Polish Parliament at work a few years ago, and I was living in Poland, and it's just like a business-like atmosphere. Somebody goes up to the rostrum, they speak for 10 minutes, they've got 10 minutes, the green light goes on, they're off, the next one comes on. It's boring, it's like watching paint dry. And of course, this is much more exciting, it's much more knockabout, but of course it's actually just a load of Yarboo sucks. And it's just this, you know, so the whole style of the debate is not very helpful or constructive to start with. And of course, the way we talk about it, Miliband versus Cameron, as if they're two, you know, superstar strikers.
Well, they're bouncing
something,
accusations,
you know,
backwards and forwards.
Yes,
aren't they?
I know, and it's just silliness. Now, in actual fact, of course, what's underlying all of this is that we've made a complete mess of our transport policy for a generation. And that, of course, reads straight back to the privatisation of the railways at the end of the major era. And
they left that back to the 1960s and the destruction of the railways.
Indeed, and the whole idea of not having a plan and just leaving it to the market and all the rest of it, which of course the Labour Party has been responsible for kowtowing to that sort of attitude. Not quite as bad as the Tories, to say they're the same would be wrong, but there's been if you go to other countries, they just regard the way we run things like transport as a joke, an absolute joke. But and I'm sure you travel around Europe, you'll have seen, they think the way we argue about this stuff is absolutely silly.
Martin Farmer, what's your view on this? Because the contrast is with something like the European Parliament, which is sort of stilted, very dull, very boring and lifeless.
Until Ian Paisley's there.
I think they shouldn't call it Prime Minister's Question Time. It seems to be turning into Prime Minister's Avoid the Question Time, to be honest. It's I'm with Martin. Basically, you travel around Europe, you go to the States, everybody views Prime Minister's Question Time really is a bit of a joke, actually. And yeah, even though you can go to the Netherlands, you can go to places like Norway and other places as well, yeah, Parliament is carried out in a more business-like fashion. I'm not sure what Prime Minister's Question Time actually adds these days.
Well, let's have a listen to a bit more of it, and you might be a bit more impressed by this comment. This one is from Michael Meacher on Wednesday in the House of Commons this week.
Mr. Michael Meacher.
Since the Sunday Times showed that in the last 2 years, the 1,000 richest persons in Britain got richer by £137 billion... enough to pay off the entire deficit, and will he therefore tax them to fund the creation of 1 million jobs, which is a far better way of cutting the deficit than prolonged austerity?
For a minute there, I thought he was talking about the Prime Minister he served under, Look, of course, I think it is absolutely essential that as we reduce the deficit, as we take difficult decisions, we are both fair and seen to be fair. And the fact is that what we've done so far has shown the top 10% of the country paying 10 times more than the bottom 10% of the country. And crucially, the top 10% in terms of earnings are not only paying more in cash terms, but are paying more as a percentage of their income. But as we go ahead with this agenda, I want to make sure that people behave responsibly and the government does too.
Now, do you think that was a little bit better, Martin Farmer? First,
no, I'm not. I'm not impressed. I'm not impressed by that. By that at all. No, it's.
But they're able to make points, aren't they? This is the whole thing. The whole thing, and actually, I would suggest it's actually better to listen to something like that, where there are some good points and some bad points made, rather than the whole thing being a business meeting where everyone's falling asleep.
I think a business meeting, but I think it's, you know, you've got some over 640 quite highly paid individuals there, but basically sat around, I suppose, in this sort of boisterous atmosphere. I don't feel it's a good use of taxpayers' money.
Martin Summers, what are your thoughts about that point there? He's saying $137 billion is the amount of the 1,000 richest people in Britain have got richer in the last 2 years. That would pay off the entire deficit.
Well, I think it's a very good point, and this is the point, isn't it? There's plenty of money around, it's just all concentrated at the top. And I think what's making people angry who are paying attention is that the wealthier have got wealthier during the crisis. You'd have thought that the crisis would have led to them losing something, and the rest of us, are losing a hell of a lot, but you'd have thought they might have lost something as well. But no, they're actually making money out of the crisis.
And I rather liked David Cameron's point about your former leader, Tony Blair, because he made £12 million, apparently, from his companies, and only paid £300,000 in tax. How does he manage that?
Disgraceful. I mean, the problem we've had, I mean, Martin has not been on the show before, but others who have been on the show will know that I'm an old Labour person, and New Labour actually is very much responsible for the mess because they're too much like the Tories, and that was the problem. We had 13 years and three election victories, and we did nothing to bring the city to heel.
It's not good for your party, is it though, Martin Palmer, that you've got your former leader is sort of prancing around with making millions and millions of pounds, and then, well, we've seen 12 million here, and yet that he's only paying £300,000 in tax. How does he manage to wangle that?
The more I look at it, I must admit, as time goes on, just reminds me of the book Animal Farm. You know, but basically you're getting to a position. Yeah, you can't tell. I mean, going back to Blair, you can't tell the difference between the Tories and Labour. And it is disgraceful.
Now let's move on to look at welfare reform, and this thing that's been going around the internet the last couple of days, the Spartacus report. Now this was on today's Daily Mail website, which is not known for its left-wing views, but we're all desperate, it says, for welfare reform, Mr Cameron, but hiding the truth is not the way to achieve it. This is Sonia Poulton writing in the Mail. She says, David Cameron's lost in his role as Prime Minister, that much is apparent. Like a toddler at a big school, he has no true understanding of the issues before him, and blunders in, apparently unaware of the danger to the danger or the need to tread carefully. His current big idea, the welfare reform bill, she says, may yet prove to be his Margaret Thatcher milk snatcher moment, the point when people will look back and shudder at the sheer callousness of it. Now, what's happened in the Spartacus report has revealed through Freedom of Information requests that the welfare reforms that are being instituted, not only did they weigh that the consultation was done, break the government's own guidelines because it was 2 weeks shorter than what the government has said the minimum period for a consultation has to be. But then there's a whole load of people, when they responded as part of this consultation, said that what the government were planning to do was actually not approving of it. 99% objected to disability living allowance, for example, no longer being used as a qualification for other benefits. And just to seal off the 90%ers, 92% of people opposed removing the lowest rate of support for disabled people. All of these things actually the government has put into the report, so it seems that the consultation was a total fake. It wasn't actually a consultation at all. It was just an exercise, possibly, in just seeing what people might have to say. But they've taken, it seems, no notice of this consultation on a bill which is going to affect millions of the most vulnerable people right across society.
Well, I mean, obviously, they don't care about what people think. They're just trying to see what they can get away with, basically. And that their calculation is that when they've brought in things like, as they're proposing, voluntary registration for voting, they're just hoping that a lot of these disabled people and their families, who are possibly not very well educated and so on, they won't register to vote, so it doesn't matter what they think, and we can do what we like to them. And, of course, in actual fact, the British people do have a sense of fairness, and when they're asked straight what about these things, they say, well, this is wrong.
Well, the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, apparently is opposing these proposals. He's so worried about how this is going to impact the disabled citizens of London. No one knew about this. It was kept away from the public dissection and would have remained so if it had not been for researchers using the Freedom of Information Act to obtain more than 500 responses to the consultation that were submitted by disabled people's organisations, disability charities and other groups. Now, I find it absolutely shocking that these public bodies are responding to a consultation, and yet you have to go through some sort of Freedom of Information request even to see what they've done. Now, surely part of the report from the consultation should have this information there freely available. It seems like the government, Martin Farmer, has got something to hide.
Yeah, it does. I'm just with Martin. I think Cameron. I mean, how does actually Cameron know what ordinary people actually want, and what their needs are? I mean, there's Cameron, a millionaire, and as it says here, sort of, you know, blunders in, totally unaware of what he's actually doing. It's as Martin said, he's just supporting his own constituency, basically.
There's also a big defeat for the welfare reform bill this week in the House of Lords. Ministers have been urged to make concessions over benefits for people with disabilities and serious illnesses following a defeat in the Lords, says Patrick Wintour, the political editor of The Guardian. Labour peer Lady Meacher said the government had crossed the line of decency with its proposed reforms, arguing that young disabled people should have an independent life even if their parents are wealthy. But the Employment Minister, Chris Grayling, said if people have savings, they cannot expect the state to support them as well. Well, Martin, that's fair, isn't it? If people have got savings, they should be using those savings to look after themselves.
OK, well, the logic of that is there's no point saving. That's the logic of that, isn't it? Now, a welfare state should be for everybody, and everybody pays something in and everybody gets something out. And if you're going to say, well, you've got to use your savings to cover yourself, well, the logic of that is I either opt out of the welfare state entirely and therefore I'm wealthy enough to save to pay for my own healthcare, whatever. Most people are not, in fact, wealthy enough to pay for their own healthcare and never will be. Or you just say, well, there's no point saving at all, so let's just not bother with any saving. And you just create a total disincentive to save. My uncle, for example, saved up to £250,000. He's now going to have to spend all of that on his healthcare because he's now gone bonkers. He had to be put in a home. Fine, brilliant. He's been a good little Tory. He's paying for his own healthcare, but he's a damn fool to have done so. He should have spent the money, shouldn't he?
I mean, my view is just quite simple. It was a guy at a trade unionist who told me when I was in my teens that the basic your health and the health service you receive shouldn't actually depend on the amount of money in your pocket. My biggest fear is we're steadily going towards a US system, and it's all right having a US system if you're fit and you've actually got money to be able to afford the insurance, because I've known people who've told me stories from the US where people haven't been fit and literally they haven't had any health care, even though they've actually been in some cases terminally ill.
Also, for the wealthy people in the US, that costs a fortune as well. They spend,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Their private system costs a bomb, because of course the people are always looking for more procedures, more drugs, more stuff to sell. It's not a health system; it's an illness system, and it's actually more expensive. And they've got 40 million people with no healthcare at all. Fantastic.
And I find what is interesting, because hospitals in the US are obviously private hospitals run for a profit. It's actually more. In fact, the National Health Service is actually more cost-effective than basic private hospitals in the US.
That's why we. That's why we put it in place in the 1940s.
Now, going back to Prime Minister's questions, Dame Joan Ruddock had a question related to benefits. This time, Prime Minister's questions this week about housing benefit.
Dame Joan Ruddock.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My constituent, Miss S, is 32 years of age, has lived alone for 8 years, and was forced onto housing benefit because of redundancy. That benefit has just been cut by nearly 50% to the shared accommodation rate. Which does the Prime Minister think is most likely? That her landlord will reduce the rent by 50%, or my constituent will be made homeless?
Well, first of all, can I congratulate the Honourable Lady for her preferment in the New Year's Honours List. I think, although I profoundly disagree with many of the things she's tried to do over her political career, mostly disarm Britain one-sidedly, I praise her for her persistent efforts. And she quite rightly... No one can accuse the... Anyway, I'm sorry. Let me answer the question very directly. All parties are committed, as I understand it, to reform housing benefit. That was Labour's commitment before the last election. The housing benefit bill is completely out of control. Labour's own welfare spokesman said last week that at £20 billion it was unacceptable and it had to change. And what we've seen so far, as housing benefit has been reformed and reduced, is actually we have seen rent levels come down. So we've stopped ripping off the taxpayer.
That was Dame Joan Ruddock putting a question about housing benefit to David Cameron, the Prime Minister, at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday this week. Now, Martin Farmer, you can see the logic here in that some people are in rather nice accommodation. What he'd like to see is actually a not quite such good accommodation for people who are paying housing benefit, just to try and get this massive bill down.
Yeah, I don't really understand where sort of Cameron's really coming from on that. It's I don't see the logic.
Well, he's actually saying that some people will have to move out and move into less accommodation because the housing benefit that is paying for accommodation which is too good for them.
And yet there's people I think who've actually been in houses, but actually been in homes. And there's Cameron literally trying to turf people out of their own homes. I don't think that's right at all.
Well, that's right. And then of course they'll turn up saying, "Will you house me?" Having been kicked out of whatever housing they're in. I mean, most of the housing benefit bill does not go on people on unemployment benefit. Most people claiming housing benefit, and most of the housing benefit bill goes to low-paid workers who don't have enough money to pay for their extortionate private rents. And you know why we've got extortionate private rents? Because we haven't built a single council house in this country seriously for 30 years. And we've got a million people under the age of 24 unemployed. How are they going to get anywhere to live? Question. And the way we reduce the housing benefit bill is build some social housing, and then the government, if it has to pay housing benefit out, will have to pay a lot less.
Well, many people,
of course, we can't do that because, well, we can't do it.
Well, many people don't realise that the word dole actually is a medieval word, which means a part or portion, most commonly of a meadow, where several persons have shares. So in a way, these kind of benefit payments are a kind of compensation for stolen land over the centuries. Now, that might be a little bit of an extension of what we're talking about here. But ultimately, Martin, do you think that there is really too much money being spent on housing benefit as a result of this?
I think Martin's basically hit it right on the head. I mean, Cadbury Heath and the area I represent, a two-bedroom house, rent of £650 to £700 a month. I mean, that's extortionate. How can a family on benefits actually afford that? Or lower wage family actually afford
that?
Yeah,
I mean, basically, we were talking about this at Speaker's Corner earlier today. I mean, if you've got a situation...
Not in Hyde Park, I'm saying. Do you want to just plug your Speaker's Corner event?
Every Friday lunchtime, we're on College Green doing a Speaker's Corner event where anybody can come speak about anything they like. But one of the things that was being discussed was housing benefit earlier today. I mean, basically, the selling off of council housing in the 1980s was a disaster. And you've got people even now in the Labour Party saying, oh, well, it was a good policy, but it just went wrong. No, it was a silly policy because it just meant that you were giving away public assets to people, and some people made a lot of money. I remember somebody writing to the Fulham Advertiser when I was living in Fulham saying, well, Margaret Thatcher's just given me £200,000 for selling me my house at this price. I feel almost obliged to vote for her. So giving houses away to the existing tenants, which is effectively what it was giving free money away. But of course, their children then want to live in Fulham and they can't because there's nowhere for them to live, so they end up living with Grandad. And that, of course, is the way of it for many young people in this country today. And when people in housing go over to the continent, they go to Germany, for example, and they say, well, what do you do with your housing crisis? And the Germans go, what housing crisis? And they say, well, you know, well, what do you do with all your homeless people? They say, well, we build houses for them. What do you do? Oh. And well, it's like many things in this country, we just put up with it. It's just absolutely silly.
I think one of the issues is, I think, the sell of council housing, and I think we're seeing it now in Hannam, and also just adjacent to the airfield at Charlton Hayes, is there's not the backfilling of affordable housing. Developers basically now are saying, oh yeah, all those commitments we actually gave on affordable housing, oh, we actually want to renege on that now because we can't actually make a business case, we can't actually make money out of it. So we're not actually that filling with affordable, well, what do you call affordable when you live in a city like Bristol? When you know to buy an affordable house, you're talking about £180,000 or £200,000.
Yeah, well, in London, you traditionally had big housing estates right next to wealthy areas because some people have to actually sort of empty the bins and do the cleaning and all the rest of it, and they can't be living out on the outside the M25 ring road. So of course, and building council housing was a way of actually forcing down the value of middle class houses. So in countries like Switzerland, the value of houses doesn't bounce around. It just stays the same because they provide social housing for poor people right next door to rich people, so rich people's housing values don't rise, and people don't, in fact, make money on their houses.
So what lobby is pushing for this then? Because, I mean, if you look at actually how much it costs to build a house in terms of labour and materials, you know, it's something around the order of about £50,000. But we're paying far, far more than that in the land value underneath. It's actually the planning permission on the land, which is most of the value of the house, by far the most.
And we have these wretched property bubbles in the southeast of England which do wash over to us here in Bristol. But of course, the rest of the country, you can buy 20 houses in Burnley for one in London. Now, this is not rational. You know, what it ultimately does is it unbalances the economy so that when we start to get going, house prices rise, they raise interest rates to knock that back, and that crushes manufacturing industry in the peripheral regions of Britain. And that's why we've lost all of our manufacturing in the Midlands, and why we've lost all of our manufacturing in the North, because we've run everything to keep the estate agents happy in the southeast of England. Now, who votes for that? Who? Well, that's the Tory core vote, isn't it?
And Martin, apparently, we may be doing the same at Filton.
Exactly, yeah. It's, it's going to be... I think that the big danger at Filton, if we're going to build 5,000 houses on basically the airfield and also on the adjoining sites, my worry is we're going to end up with rows and rows of basically potentially empty houses. And again, the developers, they talk about, yeah, we're going to put affordable housings, but as we're seeing at Charlton Hayes just next door, developers will actually renege on that because they say they can't make money just
because of the recession, basically. Yeah,
basically the recession.
Okay, another story related to benefits. Graduate Kat Riley is taking the government to court over a scheme which forces job seekers into what she calls futile, unpaid labour. Kat Riley has been looking for work since leaving Birmingham University, but she was volunteering at the museum until she was ordered to stop that and take a work placement at a Poundland store in the city. Now there's a legal challenge by her solicitor to this, which has been being discussed this week. Does this make sense? Maybe you, Martin Summers, first on this one. That she's doing work experience here, and she's organised for herself, but she's been told she's not allowed to do that. She's got to go and work at stacking shelves in Poundland for free.
Yeah, well, of course, somebody should be stacking shelves in Poundland on proper minimum wage. And so they've taken that job away from somebody that ought to be doing it and given it to a geology graduate who ought to be working for an oil company
But as you will probably remember from World War II and the concentration camps, work makes you free. Arbeit,
well, we've got to get away from that kind of idea. Ultimately, I think we're going to have to move towards what the Greens call a citizen's income, where everybody basically is paid a basic income just for being British. And they don't have to work to get it. They just get it straightforwardly. And it's very easy to administer. There's no means testing. The computer just sends you the money. Everybody gets it, including the super wealthy. So they can't complain. They're going to get it too. But at that point, people can work 1 hour, 2 hours, 5 hours, 50 hours on top of that.
But
it flexibilises the labour market and everybody's looked after.
There are a whole new generation of these sort of work placement companies that are doing these kinds of placement. And there was an article, this is back in The Observer on the 3rd of April last year, £1.4 million a year welfare entrepreneur has been picked by David Cameron to get Britons off benefits and into work.
It's in the middle of the worst recession since the 1930s. I'm on the work programme at the moment, and they won't get paid any money at all if I don't get a job within 2 years. You know what? They're going to go bust. They ain't going to succeed. They're not going to get me a job and they're not going to get anybody else a job.
A4E's latest accounts show that Emma Harrison, who runs this company, lives with her husband in Thornbridge Hall, a 12th century stately home in the heart of the Peak District, has an 85.5% shareholding in the Sheffield-based company. She receives a salary of £365,000 a year. On top of this, last year, she and her husband received an additional £462,000 for the company's use of her home for conferences and administrative work. So she's not only living in this mansion, she's also charging for the use of it for...
Yes, all of this money is taxpayers' money. And we were going on at people in the public sector being overpaid. She is a public servant and she's on £365,000 a year. Is she worth it? The answer is no.
Martin Farmer, what's your thoughts about this?
I'm exactly the same with Martin. It just seems to be ridiculous for a public servant to be earning that.
But
that
surely,
she
deserves this amount of pay if she's getting people off the dole and into work.
And yet there are public servants who basically have their pay frozen for 1-2 years. It's ridiculous.
Anyway, we're joined now by Marina Morris. Welcome back, Marina, after the Christmas and the Ukrainian New Year. So what do you have for us today?
Hello. The PIP, breast implant problem. Many women in the UK and France, most of whom paid money for beauty, are very anxious about their breast implants. The French are claiming a tentative link between faulty breast implants and cancer. After street protests in France, the French State Health Service agreed to pay to remove their implants. In the UK, the Health Secretary Andrew Leslie offered free removal, but not replacement for women on the health service, and suggested that private clinics had the moral duty to do the same. He's preparing for battle to recover NHS costs from part of the private health industry, following the declaration that companies including the Harley Medicine Group, Transform and the Hospital Group will not pay for removal of the PIP implants. The private chain claims they will go out of business if they have to pay for all of the operations, and blame government authorities such as the Medicine and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency for allowing substandard implants into the country. Surgeons of the Harley Medical Group between 2001 and 2010 operated on about 14,000 women. Transform also did around 4,000 implants during this period. Many of all of the cut price and substandard implants came from Poly Implants Prothèses, PAP in France, which used silicone gel filler of industrial grade intended for mattresses. Breast implant surgery is very popular. It is estimated between 5 and 10 million women worldwide have had the surgery, mainly for cosmetic reasons. Statistics from the American Society for Aesthetic Plastic Surgery showed it was the most popular form of cosmetic surgery in the United States in 2010, with 318,000 operations performed. It is also the most popular cosmetic operation in the UK. It's popular despite the risk, but is it right? The American Food and Drug Administration 2006 required manufacturers to study 80,000 women with breast implant for 10 years to decide if they are safe. The previous requirement was only 3 years. Other studies have shown increasing problems and decline in satisfaction as time increases. It's popular everywhere. Figures released by the International Society of Aesthetic Plastic Surgery show breast cosmetic surgery is proportionally far less popular in China, Japan, and India. Our consumerist culture, lack of knowledge, and limited vision of consequence created a desire to copy role models based on superficial attraction. Surgeons and company salesmen are selling a dream. These operations are financially profitable to the surgeons and companies. But are they in the best long-term interest of women? Is this an old way of thinking about what constitutes real, true beauty?
Lovely, Maria. Thanks very much. Martin Farmer, what's your thoughts about who should be paying for this? It's obviously a massive mistake, which has been going on over many years, this mattress silicone being used in cosmetic surgery. Sounds absolutely hideous.
Yeah, I think the cosmetic surgeons who actually put these implants should actually pay and actually remove the implants have got this industrial
but
grade.
But they've had a European kite mark on them, guaranteeing them.
Yeah, obviously. You know, if I
was a surgeon, I wouldn't necessarily have the equipment to test the silicone to make sure that it was up to standard.
But obviously, then they themselves would then have to obviously make a claim on the suppliers of the implants. But I think unless somebody's health is at risk, then it should be down to the private hospitals.
Well, we've been hearing that the private hospitals that have been being contacted by women who've had these implants are often simply not even answering the phone now.
I think that's disgraceful. I think it's disgraceful, and I think it's a clear signal that if the NHS is ever is dismantled, this is what we're all going to have to face in the future.
Well, I think it's right. I mean, it's not a mistake, is it, to use mattress silicone? It's a way of cutting costs. Mm. It's like people selling milk with chalk in it, as they used to do, and short measure and all the rest of it. And, of course, capitalism, if it's just left without being properly regulated, that's exactly what they will do.
Okay,
so that's how they make their profit.
So let's go back to the House of Commons. Just after Prime Minister's questions this week, we had a statement from the Health Secretary and subject of the Andrew Leslie rap song, Andrew Leslie himself gave a statement on these implants.
In 1997, PIP received a European CE mark for its silicone breast implants. The CE mark was overseen by the German notified body, TÜV Rhineland. The Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency's Adverse Incident Centre received a number of reports annually about PIP implants. Based on such reports, in 2008, the MHRA raised their concerns with the German regulatory authorities and the manufacturer. The MHRA were reassured by the notified body that the number of adverse reports were adequately explained by changes in the company's reporting practices and by the increasing number of implants sold. However, in March 2010, the French regulator discovered that rather than using medical-grade silicone gel in these implants, PIP had in fact been using unauthorised silicone gel. This is in clear violation of the CE mark. The mark was promptly withdrawn and all EU member states immediately alerted. The MHRA immediately issued advice to stop using PIP breast implants in the United Kingdom. The French authorities are currently investigating this as a criminal matter, and the UK government will help in any way we can with their investigation. Initial toxicology tests in both France and the United Kingdom found no significant health risk to women with the implants. Also, the MHRA could find no evidence of an increased risk of cancer. However, on the 23rd of December 2011, following an increase in the number of reported ruptures, the French Ministry of Health announced that it was advising women as a non-urgent precautionary measure to consider having their PIP implants removed. The MHRA's advice was that there was no scientific basis for recommending routine removal of implants in the absence of symptoms.
So in the fine detail of that statement, there's some pretty interesting information. This CE kite mark, which is a European version of what used to be the old British standard kite mark, the NHRA, the National Health Regulation Authority, I think that is, Martin, they said that they sent all the evidence in that there was something wrong with these things, and this private German company which certifies these things, which is called TÜV Cologne at that time, or now it was called TÜV Cologne right the way through the Second World War, now called TÜV Rhineland, the same exact company, said everything was fine. Now this company in Germany was originally set up to test boilers back 200 years ago to see if they were going to explode. This now is this private company that's now said that these back in 2008 there was nothing wrong whatsoever and gave them this kite mark.
As the minister said, this is being investigated as a criminal matter. I mean, basically, people putting mattress silicone in people's breasts knew exactly what they were doing, or at least the company supplying them knew exactly what they were doing, and that was a criminal matter. It's mafia stuff, isn't it?
So why did not regulators not pick it up? Because they were obviously shown that there was something wrong, but they just thought, well...
Well, the regulators... why didn't the regulators pick up the City of London and all of its dirty practices? Well, you know, it's a good question, isn't it?
But it seems as though it looks like this German company is just trying to increase its margins. That's its profit margins. It's just that pure and simple.
Okay, our final story. The mayor is facing court for refusing to do the census. This is the mayor of Stroud, John Marjoram. He faces a £1,000 fine. Apparently, he's going to have to come to Bristol for the pleasure of being told what his fine is, and a criminal record for refusing to complete his census form. He objected to the fact that it was an American private defence contractor, Lockheed Martin, that was administering it. Martin Farmer, do you think that's fair?
I must admit, I wasn't unaware that actually Lockheed Martin were actually administering it. It's that's actually come as a surprise to me, and maybe I might have taken the same approach that an American company is actually administering and has actually got the hold of all this information.
There were a whole load of Quakers apparently as well up in Nailsworth. They've got a beautiful old Quaker meeting house there from 300-400 years ago. Martin, what do you think about this story?
Listen, I mean, we asked people to fill in the census as a citizen so that we got the information we need to make plans about things like primary school places and so on and so forth. And in general, I would encourage people to participate in the census for good reasons. But it's absolutely intolerable that a private company, a military company, gets the contract to do this. If we're saying to people this is absolutely confidential information, it is the government that's asking you for this so that we can make statistical plans for the future, it shouldn't be contracted to somebody like that. Who the hell are these people? Are they connected to Homeland Security? And how much do they pass back with people with Muslim names to whoever? It's totally unacceptable. It's bound to create a fear, and therefore the people won't participate in it.
Okay, thanks very much. We're coming up now to time for the Sky News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, Labour Councillor for Cadbury Heath, Martin Palmer, who will be rejoining us after the news.
City station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News.